As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
It is Wednesday.
And so we have trade talks, and then we'll...
We have trade talks tomorrow at a higher level.
Partial trade talks.
We've had low-level trade talks through the week.
Why don't you bring in our partial guest?
Drew Mattis, MetLife Investment Management Chief Market Strategist. Good morning to you, Drew.
Good morning.
We're back to square one, aren't we?
It seems to be.
If the United States takes a deal like that, like the one that's been reported in the Financial Times, an extra 10 million tons of U.S. soybeans and call it a truce, what would your take be?
That we just lost. The outcome of this trade story is going to be, do we have a long-term sustainable solution for the U.S. and for China in terms of our ability to trade with each other? And if we don't end up at a place where we think it's fair trade between both countries in perpetuity, then this whole thing has been wasted. And we should have just never done it in the first place. So I think, you know, I can't imagine that this is something that's going to play well.
Yeah.
Obviously, though, markets are taking it positively. And, you know, you kind of look at that and you think to yourself, you know, should you be taking this positively or should you be thinking,
right,
as you just said, we're back to square one?
Well, the taking it positively people want to hear from Drew Mattis because you have a takingly positive view on the economy. Can you model a sub 2% GDP growth? Or are you still nicely above 2% at some form or run rate?
We're still above 2% for this year and for next year. Where it gets tricky is you're beginning to see economy-wide profit margins begin to dip a little bit. That could eventually lead to firms looking to cut back on things like investment and labor. But we haven't seen the cutoff on the labor side yet. And claims, you know, for me, claims is the most important data point around. It's not payrolls. I don't care how many jobs are created. I just need to know whether the consumer has to worry about being fired. And right now, the answer is no.
Claims are inching up just a little bit. Drew, why is that data point so important? And why for you is that not a lagging indicator? For many people, they might look at that situation and say, you know what, if we wait for hours work to drop away, for claims to pick up, we're too late to the party. In fact, the party's over.
Well, because I think we've gone through such a tight labor market for such a long period of time that I think if you asked CEOs and hiring managers, if things slow down, are you going to pull job openings? Are you not going to hire? They might say, well, we're going to be more cautious in our hiring. None of them, though, are at the point where they feel that things are weak enough where they think they can let someone go because they know someone else is waiting to hire that person. So once that person walks out the door, they are gone. And you've got to start this process of sifting through the labor market, what's left of the labor market or the part of the labor market that's looking for work, to try and replace that position.
So from a market perspective, where is the opportunity right now? Last week, we get punched in the face by a growth scare. The S&P 500 only drops a third of 1%. This week,
we are
whipsawed by trade headlines. We drop a couple of percentage points. What do you do in this environment right now? What are you suggesting people do, Drew?
We've been looking for ways to take smart risk. Know what risk you're taking, first of all, because you can take credit risk, you can take duration risk so you can lengthen your investments. You can take liquidity risk. So if you're worried about what things might do going forward, you know, one of the things that we've been looking at, you know, because of our what we're able to invest in is we look a lot at private assets right now. And the reason we do that is because we're willing to give up some of the liquidity to get the higher yield. And of course, some of those purchases also come with better protection. So you're taking potentially less credit risk, and you're getting some liquidity risk, assuming that when you go to sell your public assets, that those are actually as liquid as you thought they were in the first place.
In the stock market, can you go international? In emerging market, are you all domestic all the time with a 2% relative? That's like a relative ginormous economy, isn't it?
Well, our investment management arm is really focused on fixed income.
Yeah, I know that, but give me an equity view. Come on, it's Wednesday.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly can. And then the question is, well, you know, where do you want to expose yourself to? And I tend to think of the world in as divided into two ways. You have the U.S. supply chain.
Yeah, well
and
said.
Then you have the China supply chain.
Okay.
And although the two are linked in many ways, they are pretty distinct if you kind of dig down into the details. Yes, we all source from each other, but those two supply chains, you can usually see who's doing better by how those emerging market countries are faring.
I got to go back to your original work with Maury Harris. Fed, one and done?
We are one and done. For this year. We don't expect rate cuts next year. We don't think they're going to be necessary. And we think if you go more than one this year, then you're really calling into question this whole idea that this is a mid-cycle slowdown or that these are insurance cuts.
Priya Misra with us, and the reason you need to listen to this is John knows she adds value not only across all that John Farrow and Tom Keene do, but really adds value on the real yield. You'll see it Friday here 1 p.m. ish on Bloomberg TV. And it really has come down, John, to the real and the nominal yield.
Yep.
A permanence there.
She's fantastic, and we're lucky to get some of her time this morning. Priya Misra of TD Securities, the global head of rate strategy. Priya, let's start with the debate of the last 24 hours. It's QE, it's not QE. Chairman Powell says it isn't QE. Does it matter whether it is or isn't, Priya? What's the difference?
Yes, so hello. Thanks for having me on. Thank you for the kind words. So it does matter because, you know, I think what they're actually doing helps the repo market. It brings reserves into the system. But a lot of the impact of QE was through the signaling channel. If you remember from 2009 to 2014, when they did QE, they were actually trying to push out the start of the first hike. I thought that signal through forward guidance was probably more powerful than the actual stock of buying. So I think what the Fed is trying very hard to say is that this is not monetary policy. If they are buying treasuries and they're likely to buy bills, that this is not, we should not be taking any signal from monetary policy. So therefore, it should not mean higher stocks. It shouldn't mean lower rates. I think that signal value, it's important to distinguish. They really need another name for it. I don't love the organic QE name. It makes it sound like, what was the earlier QE, like toxic or, you know, conventional QE. So I think we need a name like reserve management buying or liability driven buying. Sort of boring names, but
liability driven buying just rolls right off the tongue. Priya, the great unspoken yesterday at the International Monetary Fund is a percent of full faith and credit debt worldwide with a negative yield. This morning, Greece, with their 3-month T-bill, a negative yield. Greece is, well, is that a linear function, or is there a kink or a tip point where there's too much negative debt?
Yeah, so I think BOJ and ECB are realizing this. I mean, I think at some point, negative rates become counterproductive. I would actually argue in the U.S., any negative rates is extremely counterproductive. It can potentially break the financial system because we've got money market funds with fixed NAVs. We've got a fractional reserve system. I actually think the U.S. negative won't work. But even in Europe and Japan, now they are trying tiering. You know, they're trying other things to try and reduce the counterproductiveness. I think essentially, you know, it's hard for a central banker to say this, but they have to say that at some point we're done. We really need the structural side. We need the fiscal side to come on, because at some point you can't keep lowering rates. So I don't think, you know, even the other central banks will probably lower much more into negative territory. But for the U.S., I think actually Chair Powell's already said it's not on his list of things. But certainly among investors, I'm getting a lot of questions that is the U.S. next for negative. And, you know, that just creates more of this reach for yield. And people take risks that they should not be taking.
This is this confidence issue again, John.
Yeah, look, I think we all think the European fixed income market is totally nuts. But is it any surprise that the 3-month bill, the yield on it in Greece is negative when you have a negative 50 basis point policy rate? at the ECB. I mean, that's what you've got to price off. Do you think Greece's money good for 3 months? Most people would assume they probably are for 3 months. Therefore, why shouldn't the yield be down there?
And there's a currency calculation there.
Yeah, look, you'll get a ton of pushback against that call, I have no doubt. But Priya, that's where we're at. It's crazy talk in the bond market. And as you point out, given where Europe is priced right now, where do yields go in the United States? One of the really interesting developments, I think, of the last couple of weeks was Japan and the BOJ really focusing on the front end, and a focus that may drift towards the Federal Reserve. Chairman Powell talked about that yesterday, Priya. What are your thoughts about it?
So I think, again, in the attempt to communicate that this asset buying is not QE, I think they're going to try and focus on the front end. I'm actually not a big fan of that because we are seeing massive inflows into the front end. So the Fed, and it all depends on how they're going to do this. I hope it's over time, and I hope they actually help the repo market through repo operations until they build that buffer. But they really should not be creating a scarcity in the front end. So I was kind of hoping that they'll buy across the curve. But I think because of the communication challenge, they have talked about the front end. I don't think it's an attempt to steepen the curve. I think it's just an attempt to say, look, we're not taking any duration risk out of the market, so don't go and take on credit risk or equity risk. That's not the intent of this asset buying.
Will there be a wave of new government paper and a wave of new issued corporate paper given permanence of low rates?
So I think government paper, absolutely. I mean, I think depending on the election next year, I actually think fiscal stimulus happens either way, irrespective of the outcome. So I do think the deficit is going to keep rising. You know, corporate is interesting. Financial conditions are extremely easy. Credit spreads are tight. And yet corporate supply seems to be declining, which I think reflects the drop in CapEx. So I actually would love from a macro standpoint if there is a pickup in corporations. But I think if CapEx is weak, then the demand side for corporates to issue all this paper, you know, do they have productive, avenues to invest?
No, they don't.
What's unclear.
Yeah, I totally take your point. And I'm going, John, I think this is a huge deal. Is there a demand for all this money that's out there to go somewhere? And I'm not sure there is.
These companies aren't complaining about access to capital or cost of capital, are they, Priya?
Right. And if it's just financial engineering, you know, there's some limit to that. So I think this is the problem. Yeah. If the Fed is trying to resolve this uncertainty, business investment, and all they do is cut rates, I'm not sure the 75 basis points of insurance cuts will be enough.
Do we need a government investment? This was an enduring theme yesterday with a managing director. You know, you're in Davos and there's a big ad on the side of a bus. You need to have infrastructure and name your Central Asian country. Are we at a point here where we finally got to do infrastructure coast to coast and worldwide?
Yes, I think politically that might be harder in certain parts of the world. I think in the U.S., once we get the election out of the way, I think when policymakers are sort of looking at how do you stimulate, I think infrastructure is the way out. It's just going to be up to details. Is it all fully government funded? I think all of that we have to figure out. But I'm kind of hoping that as we get into full-on campaign season, that both parties will sort of bring up this infrastructure idea as a boost to aggregate demand in 2021. But that's a bit far off.
Priya Misra, thank you so much. TD Securities.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
John, a lot going on right now. I see Brazil, it's a piece of data here on an emerging market with some inflation there, but we knew that. Global growth really ebbing in here. And a lot of talk yesterday, John, on food prices in China is a real domestic constraint within their debate. It's out well in excess of 2 standard deviations on pork prices as well. With JOHCM Funds, the head of their credit, their rate market.
Don't butcher this.
Okay, then you, please.
Go on. You've got it. Have a go.
Lyle Topagulu. Did I do okay?
Lyle Topcholu.
Topcholu.
There we go.
You set me up for this, didn't you?
He totally set you up.
Oh, you're in on this too?
I'm not in on it. No, I'm in trouble.
Do you know the great Mark Crumpton?
It's great to see you, Lally.
Mark Crumpton's in the News Hall of Fame in Washington. He keeps a list in his desk of all the names I mispronounce.
Oh, boy.
So you're on an August list right now. John, bring in our sainted guest this morning.
What's her name? Lally Topcioli. He's going to get it right at some point, Lally. I promise you. It's great to see you.
Thank you.
Let's talk about this market. Last week, it was recession on, recession off. This week, it's trade deal on, trade deal off. You must be really, really frustrated at the moment as someone staring at this market, looking at how it's whipsawed by one headline to the next. What are your thoughts at the moment?
You know, I wouldn't say frustrated. I think I sometimes just put the blinders on. It's the same story that just repeats and repeats and repeats and repeats. And there's no need to do knee-jerk reactions. If you sort of scratch the surface in the market, it's the same story. Defensives are expensive, both on the equity and the credit side. And the credit overall just seems really expensive. It's actually one time, and you know how opinionated I am on pretty much everything. I really just lack conviction. I don't know where we're going to go from here.
We haven't broken out of some key ranges in credit. In high yield, for instance, for high yield spreads, really the range of 2019, the tights in and around 350 basis points, the wides through much of the year in and around 450 basis points. And right now, where are we? Somewhere slap bang in the middle.
435, 440, something around there.
Pushing the upper end.
But here's the thing, though. So this is where the top down and the bottoms up really differs. If you look at it from top down, you will see month to date, we're about, call it, let's say, 40 bips wider. What's really fascinating is, you know, if you look at the sectors, energy, do you know year to date energy returns are actually negative 1%? High yield is up 13%. Where people are hiding out, like in defensives, like cable sector, is up 16.5%. So, and here's the other stat, which I think people forget. 2/3 of the high yield index trades inside the index, and the rest third is like cats and dogs. It's really hard to find value. And I think this is where, you know, I always do the advertisement for active management.
Of course.
You need somebody to dig through the rubble to find you the value and where to go, because top-down numbers can be misleading.
Well, what kind of signal do you take away from something like triple Bs, which is the bottom of the stack in investment grade, and triple Cs, bottom of the stack in high yield? That spread, I think, is the widest in several years. What kind of signal do you take away from that, Lally? The outperformance that you're getting in and around the border of investment grade and high yield, and the underperformance that you're getting right at the bottom?
Well, look, the triple Cs, majority of them struggle. They're either secular pressures or cyclical pressures, and some of them just has to restructure. Triple Bs, you know, it's simple supply and demand. Look at the flows that are coming into credit. You just got to buy. It's phenomenal flow. There's nothing you can do.
I want to congratulate you on arguably the essay of the month on accounting. It is a fabulous workout of what's called adjusted EBITDA. Now, on a Wednesday, we're not going to do this. On a Friday, we go into this in detail. But the bottom line is something down the income statement that is taken as gospel by the street is suspect. Why should I not be addicted to adjusted EBITDA like I'm addicted to the VIX?
Because it's nonsense. It's made up.
It is a calculation of the income statement pulling in depreciation from the balance sheet, right? That is made up, no question about that.
It is. And I think EBITDA, to a degree, in certain industries, can give you a clue. I'm not against EBITDA. What I'm against is adjusted EBITDA, where we start adding back things, which internally we call them, you know, management's past sins. Mm-hmm. Like, you opened up more stores that you needed at retail. Well,
right.
That's
called Forever
back.
21.
Okay. Those should not be given the benefit. You messed up. Okay. You messed up.
This is critical, and I don't want to get you in trouble with your general counsel, but with WeWork, WeCompany, and community adjusted EBITDA, are we finally at a point, not that we wander back to the romance of Graham Dodd and Cottle, but are we finally at a point where we get away from some of this adjusted foolishness?
No. Because
she answers single word questions. How'd you let her in the room?
She's very, very straight about how she answers questions.
No, because, I mean, I was glad that there was some rationality perhaps was coming back into the market as people actually read through the prospectus, perhaps in the first time, which is a good start. But look at, you know, I'm looking at some of the high yield deals that really remind me of my leveraged loan days back in 2006, 2007, where we would start with like negative 29 of EBITDA, we would add back and it would be $200 million of EBITDA, and that's what the deal is sold. And here is the catch. This is where people forget. That's what runs, that's where your covenants run off from. That's what determines how much leverage you put on business.
I want to make clear, folks, covenants isn't Raiders of the Lost Ark in 2006. It's what got us into trouble.
What do you think the consequences of this will be? You've written extensively about it. I know you have. I've read about it. But for the benefit of our listeners, Lale, this covenant light era of the last, especially the last few years, what do you think the consequences of that will be?
Well, it's going to be a prolonged default cycle. It's going to be substantial lower recoveries. And I think, you know, I joke and I say the world is upside down. And you're actually seeing it more in the leveraged loan market now, where people are supposed to be secure and feeling good about it. It is estimated that the leveraged loan recovery this cycle is going to be around 55 cents as opposed to 75 historically. And technically, you're secured. I think people forget, again, this is just the top-down investing and running with our historical knowledge. The world is really upside down.
Lale, you don't just talk the talk, you walk the walk too. I should congratulate you on the year so far. Your JOHCM income fund is up, I believe, about 19% through 2019 so far.
Yeah.
So let's talk about security selection. What are you doing at the moment? What are you focused on?
Well, simplistically, trying to avoid the losers and just focus on the winners, which is really hard to do on credit. I mean, I don't think we've actually bought a single bond in the last 3 months.
Really?
Is that top of the market nothing.
Because of issuance? It's just a frenzy now where you just have to step aside.
It's just the pricing does not price for what I would consider to be the risk premium. You don't get compensated for taking on what I would consider to be a less liquid piece of paper. That's just the nature of the high yield market. Right. And I think the covenants are poor and the leverage is misrepresented.
Lale, it's great to catch up with you. Got to let you go. I wish we had more time with Lale.
We should have her back again.
We are going to do that. Lale Topcholu of JOHCM. Joining us right here on Bloomberg Surveillance.
I want to stay in geopolitics right now because the news is literally breaking. I'll read you the Chinese press release here. Just it's one of them with a couple paragraphs to it. We bring in Elaine Kaimark with us with the Brookings Institute. She has written wonderful books on the presidential history, presidential messaging, presidential structure and governance. And Elaine, I need to rip up the script and go right to Turkey. This is the Chinese treatment from Xinhua of Mr. Erdogan announcing on Wednesday that Turkey launched Operation Spring of Peace in the northern Syria. Quote, together with the Syrian National Army, our Turkish armed forces launched the Operation Spring of Peace towards the PKK, YPG, and Daesh, the Islamic State terrorist organizations. And this goes, folks, this is 7-8 hours away from us, 4:30 in the afternoon. Elaine, this takes in all history an apparatus of the United States of America to treat, to provide intelligence, to consider a set of responses. Is that apparatus remotely in place right now?
The apparatus is fully in place. The commander-in-chief, however, operates without consultation of the people on the ground. The military is furious at this. The general who was in charge of this until he retired in March has written in Defense One, it's an online military blog, about how appalled he is at Trump's action by pulling out American forces from the Kurdish occupied territory. President Trump has put at risk 10,000 ISIS fighters who have been guarded by the Kurds. So if chaos erupts and the Kurdish guards are fighting the Turks, as they appear to be doing at any moment, then 10,000 ISIS fighters, most of whom are more than happy to go back and join the fight against the United States, we'll be roaming around and potentially rearming.
I'm going to try to paint the map here quickly, Paul Sweeney, in that we know where Syria is on the Eastern Mediterranean, call it north and northeast of Israel. And then you go up to that border with Turkey, 400-500-600 miles long. You're 800 miles away from Istanbul. You're 400 miles northeast, I should say, from Damascus. And all the maps show a presumed safe zone or border. Paul, I don't know how many miles that is. Is it a Gaza Strip width? I don't know. But it seems the messaging is a safe zone.
Exactly. So, Elena, I think a lot of people are trying to, you know, get their hands around the news over the last couple of days of President Trump's policy shift as it relates to the Kurds. What do you think are the short-term and long-term implications of what the president just did?
Well, the short-term implications are clearly that the Republican senators whom he needs to defend him against impeachment are now criticizing him, including two of the most powerful and strongest allies. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Senator Lindsey Graham are appalled at this action. And I don't know if they can take any action to stop it or reverse it, but it may be too late. So in the short term, this seems to be very tone-deaf politics. In the long term, it clearly means that no one's going to trust the United States of America in international affairs. No one has been a better ally to us in that region than the Kurds. And the Kurds are also very good fighters, and they have fought with us and died with us. You can find a clip of Trump even commending the Kurds for fighting with us in the fight against ISIS. And now he has abandoned them to slaughter.
Just for the sake of discussion, I'm going to take the tact of the president tweeting. I'm not going to go over the tweets this morning. There's over a dozen of them. But bottom line, he says, the emotion of America is why are we in those distant wars? I mean, it sounds like Jefferson and the, you know, the Barbary Pirates of another time. Tell me, Elaine, the history, which you are expert on, of our emotion of our men and women in distant wars.
We have had men and women in distant wars since the end of the Second World War when we became a world power. And we have intervened in very many places where we shouldn't have been. And then we've intervened in places where it made sense for our national security. When you had an enemy like ISIS that was chopping off people's heads and taking kidnapping victims and causing havoc throughout the region, it made sense for the United States to come to the aid of people who were trying to defeat ISIS. Does this mean that every intervention has been correct? No, of course not. But sometimes the United States does the right thing in the world, and in this instance, we did. And therefore, a blanket foreign policy of withdrawing from the world is apt to cause more harm than good.
So, Elaine, you mentioned, you know, the impact on the Republicans. How do you think this is going to, as we go to impeachment, and that's kind of where the president has been tweeting very aggressively, that's certainly top of mind, not surprisingly. How do you think the impeachment thing is just going to play out?
I think what's going to happen is that we will see the House write articles of impeachment. And one of the first decisions they have to make is what do they write articles on? For instance, it's clear that they can write an abuse of power article based on the conversation with the Ukrainian president. It's clear that they can write an obstruction of justice article based on actions during the Russian investigation and based on yesterday's decision not to respond to any of the House's inquiries and requests for information. So the question is, what else? And I think that one of the things that is throwing a sort of wrench into this is this action he took with regard to the Kurds, is this in fact something that should be included in an article of impeachment because it is in fact dangerous to U.S. national security? And I think that they're going to have to noodle that one, and I don't have a good sense of that.
This has been a great brief. Thank you so much. Elaine Komarek with us with breaking news here on Turkey. A lot of other news as well to look at. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.